Today, I catalog a little of my own journey to faith. You that I've pastored now going on 15 years know, and I confess it each year, this is perhaps the most difficult message or lesson that I've taught over the years. And I've never been able to figure out why. I'm sure one of the reasons is that the subject matter deserves 7 days of 24 hours each, and to compress many years of research on the subject down to just these few minutes is difficult. Another reason is probably because I've done it so often with you. But the church has suffered over the years by neglecting this, its fundamental message. So once again, we dive into the subject. Let me test you and see if I have to pull that blind behind me. Can you see that? I can't. Yeah, I can see it now. You way up there can't, but when I put it on the board, why are you and I making an issue? When has anybody been able to read anything I write on the board? When I was at Stanford doing my doctorate, Dr. Kishimoto was visiting from Tokyo University. He was the successor in academic circles to Onosaki, who for many years had been recognized as the leading Buddhist scholar of the Far East. Kishimoto was here on a special grant to study 5 consecutive years at 5 leading universities, really 4 universities and 1 seminary, Union Theological Seminary, and 4 other leading universities to study religion in this country. His 5th stop was at Stanford University. And as a guest lecturer, he was teaching a class of his own creation in which he compared the developing concepts of Christology, those views that, in his presentation of it, developed over many years, accruing to Christ a designation of divinity, compared to the development through history in the Far East of the attribute of divinity on Buddha. I learned early in college to not debate my professors, but at the doctoral level, I decided to start practicing a little bit. And I wrote a paper in which I challenged the historic basis of what he was saying, the premise being that the claims about Christ were the first messages preached about Christ. Whereas in the case of the Gautama Buddha, who was a historic prince in India, who had sought relief from a sense of sin that in their philosophy is described with the word tanya. We translate it as thirst, but it doesn't really come to grips with it. That thirst that keeps us grabbing for things in this earth. And having tried sensuality and not finding deliverance from the sense of thirst, and then the way of the yogi and aesthetic extremism, he came to the so-called middle path, which he then passed on to his followers, the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. Every 200 years after his death, his followers would gather in what were called Samgitas. And as you plot the history of these every 200-year gatherings, you can find the exact point in history where his followers decided, some many centuries after his death, that despite his own denials of any special place other than the experience that he had and communicated to others, they decided he could not have done what he did if he were not divine. By contrast, the earliest records of Christ, and I don't care which records you want to pick, there's a lot of debate on which gospel's first. I know God gave the King James to Moses on Mount Sinai, and Matthew's the first gospel. But scholarship has pretty much settled it. Mark wrote before Matthew and Luke, those three being the three synoptic gospels, and that Matthew and Luke, if you can read the Greek, you'll find a change of style occasionally for little pockets of information or quotations. And if you look at Mark, you'll find they have adopted his style and most likely are quoting from him. You break these three synoptic gospels down a bit more, you will find that all three of them change to an unknown style with certain bodies of sayings and certain all three repeated events. This gave rise to a so-called and hypothetical Q document. There was some for a while when the Nag Hammadi find of Gnostic scriptures was unfolded, beginning in the 60s and into the 70s, after the initial political rigmarole about it, that possibly the Gospel of Thomas attached to that group might be the Q document. I think that's been abandoned by now. But some common source is recognizable in the style of the writings in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that indicates they must have had another source to draw upon in addition to Matthew and Luke drawing upon Mark. One of the church fathers said that Matthew wrote down the sayings of Christ when he was with him, not in Greek, but in either Hebrew or Aramaic. There are others who think that might be the long-lost so-called Q document. I had a professor who ridiculed our scriptures, saying, you don't have anything past the 5th century. Well, we may not have any existing complete uncial manuscripts past the 5th century, but I asked him about Tatian's Diatessalon, a harmony of the gospel put together about 170 A.D. He didn't know what it was. And no matter what the source, as you trace back through those fragments, the Torian fragment, the sayings of the fathers, from the fragments remaining from Ignatius and Polycarp and those that trace their appointment in the church to the earliest disciples, you find them quoting scriptures which can be assimilated to give a common body of that which we do find in the later canonized documents. The point I'm making, wherever you turn to make a statement about Jesus the Christ, you're led to some historic document, because Christianity is in that body of faith that points to a founder. Buddhism points to a founder. Christianity points to a founder who was on the stage of history, and nobody seriously questions anymore that there was a historic Christ. Tatian, a heathen, gives us enough record of that. Tacitus, the Roman historian, takes us beyond that dispute. And this founder was at a place in time, striding a historic stage, as was Buddha already said, Confucius, and Muhammad. Islamic people don't like to be called Mohammedanisms. They don't worship Muhammad. There's one God, Allah. Muhammad is his prophet. It's the Islamic faith. These are historic faiths that have a founder. And you go to historic records. The problem with Christianity, and I confronted it early in college, and this is what I wrote to Dr. Kishimoto, having plowed through my own agnosticism from a hard study. The rest of these founders of religious faiths, you can trace through history. and find the point where, in spite of their own denials, as already said about Buddha, their followers project back to them divinity. The problem that distinguishes Jesus is that from the outset, the message was an unbelievable testimonial of miraculous being. The first message was he rose from the dead. From the earliest hymns, whatever the source, you will find Jesus making such ridiculous claims about himself that history disallows. Putting him on the pedestal of respect, we give the Gautama Buddha and we give Muhammad. This is why I wrote to Kishimoto. I said, the history's wrong. You are acting as though there is a parallel between a developed and projected back faith of the followers in the Gautama Buddha's divinity, and that can be analogized to followers of Christ projecting back and stamping onto him some kind of attribute of divinity that contradicts his own belief about himself. Kishimoto called me in after the paper and invited a year of individual study over the balance of the year, and we spent the following months of his tenure at Stanford with me presenting the claims of Christ against the backdrop of his scholarship in Buddhism. And I have always said, I don't, like the TV evangelist, I don't try to cram my faith down anybody's throat. I simply try to get everyone that I'm associated with to think out their own faith, know what they believe and why they believe it, and I am disturbed that so many Christians have never thought out their own belief and why they believe it. Every Easter the song is sung, "You ask me how I know he lives. He lives within my heart." That's raw Gnosticism. The subjective experience may be valid to you, for I haven't had your experience, nor have you had mine. And Christianity as a faith is based upon some objective facts that culminate in the claim of the resurrection. And it is those facts I would lead us to today. What I said to Kishimoto, I repeat to you. There are things, no matter what the source, and I took the time to catalog a series of sources, doesn't matter which one you look at. I confronted in university that which shook my faith because I transferred authority from expertise in areas they were specialists in to religious pronouncements of my professors, and discovered after a while I had abandoned my faith to take a substitute offered by those who ridicule my earlier faith. It was not the result of any study. The remarkable thing about humankind, everybody thinks they're born an expert in religion. You can get a religious opinion from the guy trying to bum a nickel from you out here. Politics and religion, you don't have to study to be an expert. Study the experts and you'll see. I confronted a wall in the intellectual world when I started my university career. It's okay to accept Jesus as a good and wise teacher. Wonderful moral pronouncements, marvelously good man, as long as you don't add that impossible stuff. Supernatural, divine Son of God, Messiah. Take that off of Christ and park him on a shelf of respectability with Buddha and Muhammad and Confucius, and you can get along fine in the intellectual world. The problem, redundantly being repeated to me this morning, is Jesus doesn't fit there. Because wherever you confront Christ in history, and I skip through a multiplicity of sources, pick your own source. They're always going to take you to somewhere you find Jesus saying something or doing something that gets him the credit, good and wise teacher. Give me that source. If it has minimal respect in the historic community as a historic document reporting things known and witnessed about Christ, you're going to find Jesus saying things that disallow good and wise teacher as the characteristic applied to him. For example, we're off and rolling now, he seated authority in himself. How many of you ever wanted to make a saint out of a know-it-all? Yeah. Here comes the guy. When he says it, that settles it. Well, what do you mean? What do you base that on? Me. I said it. Now, every respected leader of any religion in the world gets his reputation for respect because he gives us an objective criteria for his authority. The Gautama Buddha, I already briefly sketched, was a prince in India. After his kids were raised, he sought deliverance from the tanya or thirst that he could not get released from, that identified him with this world that they viewed as appearance and not reality. And he tried the two extremes. And he came to what I've already said is the Eightfold Path. Never once did he claim divinity. Their view of ultimate reality is expressed in the strange phrase, the that behind all that. To them, ultimate reality was nothing. And appearance was the wheel of life that we keep spinning around in. And the so-called yogi exercises are not to make you pretty, but to give you a release from identity with the things of this life. And salvation in Buddhism is nirvana, where the wheel of life stops turning. With the karma you build up in life, you're constantly identified with this world. If you act like a pig in this life, to oversimplify it, you'll be born a pig in the next life. And everything has life, and you revolve around this wheel of life. And the goal of the Gautama Buddha, the prince in India, was to get out of the clutches of that. And I sort of share his feeling on occasions. He did it by attaining a trance-like state in the so-called Eightfold Path that gave him release from identity with this world, and that nirvana, by their theory, stopped the buildup of karma. And as he lived the rest of his life, instead of having to go around another circle, when his life ended, he would become one with the that which is behind all that, and he offered to those that followed him simply that path. He's on record in their scriptures, in their tripart basket of scriptures. I have some in our collection that we'll show back here. He, in his own words, said his life meant nothing. He was unworthy to lead the band. His death meant nothing. All he could leave them was the path that brought the experience that gave to him the satisfaction he had. Objective external criteria of authority. Try my path and see if it gives you the peace that my experience gave me. Confucius did a logical analysis of society and deduced from that analysis an objective plan of the perfect city and the perfect brotherhood. He said, you try my way, it'll work. One city tried it, didn't work. He said, you didn't do it right. But he gave an objective external criteria for his judgments. Muhammad never ever claimed to be God. He claimed visions. Extremely attractive if you live in a desert place. And these visions, much like Moses, who received from a contact with other worldly life, eternity, wrote down that which he had received as the message. Muhammad, likewise, was a prophet who had dreams and visions, who objectified those visions in the Quran, and he never himself claimed to have the authority. He received the authority from someone else. In each of these cases, the criteria of authority was external to self. In Buddha's case, an experience he had. In Confucius' case, a logical analysis that you could follow through the pattern on. In Muhammad's case, an experience of visions. in which the Lord above him, Allah, had communicated, and he reduced it to these objective words. Only Jesus goes around wherever you find him, putting authority in himself. He stood in front of the Pharisees, the experts of the law, and said, "You've heard it said unto you, thou shalt not kill. But behold, I say unto you, if you hate in your heart, you're as guilty as a murderer." He said, "You've heard it said unto you, thou shalt not commit adultery. But behold, I say unto you, the thought is bad as the deed." He changed age-old principles. He never claimed a vision. He never made any new analysis of society. He never claimed a unique experience. He said, "You've heard it said unto you, but behold, I say." There is no greater test of authority than when you judge someone else. The Scripture says, "Judge not that you be not judged." Nothing humbles a true man of character like having to judge another, because we know none of us are in any position to play judge on another unless we have an awful limited brain. But he never hesitated. Here comes the image of religious respectability. He says, "You're whited sepulchres, painted white on the outside like a grave painted over, but inside you're full of dead men's bones." He forgave sin without the slightest hesitancy. "If you have any conscience, try it." He looked at the woman everyone else was going to stone. Says, "Go. Neither do I condemn thee. Thy sins be forgiven thee." Who's he to forgive sins? He said, "You build on what I say." Again, I could spend 7 days on just his sayings from different sources, but let's pick a few. "You build on what I say." You build on a rock. You build on anything else, you build on a sand. Now, I've only started in some of his claims, the first one today. You know what my dad would do today? If I said, "Now that I got you downtown, folks, I've been holding back. You build on anything else, you build on sand. All authority in heaven and earth given unto me." I bet you Bruce would not so readily say, "My friend Gene Scott," if I started saying. Everything you've ever heard is thus and so. "But behold, I say." My friend Ed Masry would be calling a psychiatrist in the board of the church and saying, "Has he gone the way of those other religious nuts?" The point I make, you don't put people who cede authority in themselves with no objective criteria in hero status. You put them with Father Divine, Prophet Jones, maybe even Jimmy Jones. You don't put them in a respected camp. But everywhere you confront Jesus, you find him ceding authority in himself and making pronouncements with no outside criteria. You're supposed to believe it because he says it. Number two, he thought he was perfect. I don't care. If I meet a man who says, "I know the Christ of history, and I don't have any interest in him, because I do not believe that he has any divine or supernatural basis, and the claims he made about himself tell me that he does not deserve the character designation of good and wise teacher." Because we don't saint people who think they're perfect. You ever met one? It's like the know-it-all. You ever met the guy that's never wrong? Huh? Never wrong. I mean, not even 2%. I mean, I don't mind giving 98%. But can't you bend just a little bit? Jesus thought he was perfect. Now, the issue is not whether he was or not. I don't really think there is a universal definition of sin. I think there's a universal sense of oughtness. I think, Father, the image of God in man, as Ryan Lieber puts it, is that need to feel that what we're doing is right. Even a crook wants to be a good crook. There is that urge in us to justify our behavior and know that at least some part of us is committed to the right. It's that sense of ought. And that sense of ought is fulfilled when you find the revelation of the right, whatever you have thus chosen. But the issue is not whether he was perfect. Some different standard might say no. The issue is, he thought he was. Buddha knew he wasn't. That's why he sought deliverance from that sense of shortcoming and domination by Tanya. Confucius certainly knew he wasn't, and at no time did Muhammad, as the prophet of Allah, feel that he was without fault and as perfect as Allah himself. But everywhere you can encounter Jesus, there's no sense of moral imperfection. He says, I'm come to destroy the law, after, mind you, defining it at a bone marrow level. Not just the surface, but the thought makes you guilty of the deed. In the long speech about murder as an external act versus hatred and adultery versus a heart filled with lust, having defined the standard higher than had ever been uttered, he then without a phase of any hesitancy, but I didn't come to destroy the law. I came to fulfill it. I already mentioned forgiving sin. You've got to have a pretty good sense of your own perfection to think you can forgive someone else's sins. Now someone quickly holds their hand up and says, what about the time Jesus said, why callest thou me good? The rich young ruler comes running to him saying, good master, good rabbi, literally, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And as you read the story, he has a simple frame of reference. Moral, behavioral goodness. Because when Jesus says, do this and this and this, he says, I've done it from my youth up. So he has the attitude that goodness is complete perfection on all righteous acts as revealed by God. And he dashes up to Jesus and says, good rabbi, what must I do more? Jesus said, why are you calling me good? There's none good but God. Now those that want to have a moral imperfection in Jesus really play off of that one. The alternative is, and the right view is, Jesus refused to let him address him, that rich young ruler address Christ, as good rabbi, unless he was prepared to recognize that only God could be good. So if you're going to call me good, recognize that only God can be as good as that which you're implying. So don't go call me good rabbi unless you're also prepared to recognize you're talking to that which can only be good to that degree, namely God himself. Wherever you confront Jesus, no sense of moral imperfection. We often hear the Lord's Prayer when we come to church. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, among other things. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those that trespass against us. That's not the Lord's Prayer. There's no record of them ever praying it. These other founders, you find their followers emulating their spiritual exercise. In Jesus' case, they said, teach us to pray. He didn't say when we pray. He said when ye pray. Say this, among other things, forgive us our trespasses. Nowhere in history will you find Jesus showing forth any sense of moral inadequacy. The true Lord's Prayer is recorded by John in his 17th chapter. It's full of arrogant presumption, of moral adequacy. No repentance. He says, Father, I have completed the task you gave me to do. I have delivered the word you sent me to deliver. Now restore to me the glory that I had. No sense of, Father, I hope I've done well enough, and now that my job's coming to a close, I hope that I'm going to get A's and not just B's and C's and maybe an F. Absolute presumption. I've done everything you sent me to do. Now restore me to the glory I had. The prayer reeks with moral adequacy. In contrast to the other founders who start their religious journey with a sense of moral inadequacy. We don't saint those who sense no fault. Thomas Carlyle says, the greatest of all faults is to be conscious of none. In that sense, Christ committed the greatest of all faults because throughout his historic record, he has no sense. He has a consciousness of none. Now, he could be good on these two points if he believed that all authority was seated in himself. He could be good if he believed that he was perfect. He couldn't be wise by any reportive meaning of that word, because anyone we would credit as wise at first glance would not be stupid enough to believe the impossible about themselves. He could be wise by being smart enough to foolish a few deluded followers into these beliefs about his authority and his perfection. He sure is not good because he's defrauding us. And there began to be a crack in my own view of what was being peddled to me by men who deserve my respect in their specialties, but not in Christianity. I'm an undergraduate history and major. I remember going to my lead professor that I was reading for in those days and saying to him a question about a problem in a term paper I was doing on the Civil War. He said to me, Gene, now he taught general history and was head of the department. He said, Gene, I'm not an expert on the Civil War. Go see Charlie Scott. Not a relative. That's his specialty. And I thought to myself, these men deserve the respect they have as professors, because they're cautious. They will not speak on a subject they haven't studied. Not even a historian teaching history in college will speak on a subject about the Civil War, because that's not his specialty. But this same man, whom I was reading for, continued to buffet me with a perceptual frame. Finally, he blurted it out. He said, Gene, I understand. I look at your grades. I look at the work you do for me. I see the way you tackle a problem in scholarship. I can't understand how you're hanging on to this faith that you have in Jesus Christ as supernatural. And he said, I've concluded the only explanation is you must have some vestigial emotional tie to the faith of your father. Well, I'm sure that was true, but that wasn't why I hung on to the faith. These viewpoints are so easy to accept. I mean, who's going to get mad at anybody for calling Jesus a good and wise teacher? You will salute him. We're going to get along now. But the facts are, he can be not a good and wise teacher unless the things he thought and said about himself are true. You cannot, as a mortal man, make these kinds of claims. And to make it worse, he talked about eternity and expected me and you to believe he knew it from the inside. If I say to you, the couch in my living room is red, you're going to say, how do you know it's red? You don't do that. We assume, when I start talking about my home, the manner in which I discuss it, you assume I know what I'm talking about. Now, Muhammad, he talked of heaven that was very attractive to people in the desert, with flowing springs and lots of other things that were better than where most of his readers at the outset were living. But he never said, I came from there. He described the heaven he had received in vision. The Gautama Buddha spoke of his experience of having touched ultimate reality, attained nirvana that stopped the wheel of life, and he could describe the experience he had, which could be attained by each of his apostles, he said, or disciples, if they followed the same path. He didn't know what lay beyond. It was just the that which was behind all that. Confucius, they once asked him about life after death, and he said, I can't solve the problems of this life. So don't ask me about the ones in the next one. The point I make is, I could make claims like Muhammad or Buddha if I had the experience, or Confucius if I made the analysis, and not embarrass my dad or my friends. But Jesus talked in weird ways. He said, before Abraham I was. Now, I know this is a heavy subject today, and it's not one we jump around and have a good time like we did last Sunday, but I'm not this bad yet. There would be more than a little restlessness in here if I came out and said, I was there when Satan was cast out. I watched him fall. You talk about your father Abraham. I was there before him, and not the way General Patton does it. You know, General Patton, he walks out on this ancient battlefield, and the driver said, but General, it's down there. No, I don't know where it's at. Turn off here. And I walk out there, and I've got a few pictures of General Patton, but I've forgotten those. General Patton's George C. Scott now. He walks out there and slaps his leg and goes here. Goes here. And his aide's looking at him with eyes like saucers and says, General, you talk like you were here. Oh, but I was. Because he believed in reincarnation. That isn't the way Jesus talked. He expected us to believe he was always there when the worlds were formed. He said, I go to prepare mansions for you. I'll come again and get you. He lived in a realm of delusion that permeates his statements, that if you take the time to take an honest look at any source, here is a man who obviously believed he'd come from another space or sphere or world and was here temporarily and could give us some glimmers of what had always been, because he'd always been there watching it, and would go back and get things ready and come back and get us and take us there too. I mean, there's a cult down here in Long Beach that, I don't like to use that word because it's too often derogatory instead of descriptive, but they are not within the main line of historic Christianity, and their leader's in a spaceship out there somewhere. I respect their belief. The Supreme Court, in one of those not mainline series of religions, which are in trouble now since Scalia wrote his decision this past week, and what I've been telling you people for the last 10 years has now come true. From clear and present danger to compelling state interest, now religion is a luxury, and you've got to prove the right to have it. And the government doesn't have any burden now to come and step on your religious rights. And I've been telling this community and the world that for the last 15 years. Now it's arrived, and I have to say I told you so again. But there wasn't an out-of-mainstream religious group that had their religious experience up on Mount Shasta. And they got in trouble because someone saw their leader in St. Louis walking the streets when he was claimed to be on Mount Shasta. And the Supreme Court in earlier days recognized the right of freakish religions said the issue is not whether he was in two places at once. The issue is whether or not he was believed to be and believed himself to be. But we don't make saints of those kind of people. We used to give them their religious rights, but you don't put them on an elevated plane. People who expect that, what would you say? Before you and Mom got excited about me, I was. Well, I have a libel suit I want you to represent me on, Ed. There are some people out there that do not believe and have accused me of lying in saying that before Abraham I was. Now, that will challenge your skills. I'm not saying whether these things are true or not. All I'm really seeking to accomplish by this long trail this morning is you cannot just write Jesus off with some little wave of the hand that says, I haven't got time to look at him, but it seems to be respectable to call him a good and wise teacher. No, you can't. If he's good, then he's deluded into believing his eternal existence. Not wise, he's wise enough to delude us, as with these other things. Certainly not good, he's a fraud. He put himself the center, and I'll improve this blackboard next Sunday. He put himself the center of the religious universe. It gets worse. If you think this authority bit, or moral perfection sense, or his expecting me to believe he viewed the eternal world from the inside is bad, try this one on for size. I got you here today. Now, you want to know how you get eternal life? Accept me as your Lord and Master. Look, the issue is not what I teach. Me. Come unto me, all ye that are heavy laden. I'll give you rest. Come on, let's get these special gears we put on in church off and let words mean what they're supposed to mean. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the door. By me, ye shall enter in. Anybody goes any other way, thief and the robber. I'm the door of the sheepcot. I am the water of life. I am the light of the world. What you do with me personally determines your eternal position. Somebody would already be calling a church board meeting in the lobby back there. I hope after 15 years, with some mercy, before you scuttle me completely, but at least we got to do something about Pastor. Jesus did not come teaching an improved ethical way. The Gautama Buddha, he had tried, as I said, the two extreme available ways. He now offered the eightfold middle way, he called it, the eightfold path that had delivered him. I've already said Confucius offered his analysis that would better society if you would practice his perfect city. Muhammad, he offered Allah's way, not his way. Jesus put himself the center. What you did with him as a person. He that cometh after me must deny himself. If any man hate not his father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister, yea, and his own life, for my sake, cannot be my disciple. Permeating everything he did and said, he put himself the center of the religious universe. It was what you did with him as a person. You cannot separate his ethical message from the man, because he never once said his ethical message would get the job done. He forced himself center stage. We put people in the nut fringe who make those claims. He could be good, I repeat, and believe the impossible. He certainly cannot be wise, and he's none but a fraud if he tries to convince us. He also said there was something wrong with the whole world that could only be set right by his death. It permeates his teaching in all sources. He accepts without the slightest, and this also plays on the fact that he thought he was perfect. When he came upon John the Baptist, he accepted without hesitation, "Behold the Lamb of the world." In a context and a perceptual frame where those listening had grown up around the religious traditions and reality of the Paschal Lamb, of the Great Day of Atonement, of the Passover Lamb, of the Lamb that was offered as vicarious sacrifice for sins. The Old Testament's full of a lot of blood sacrifice. Simple reason. In the Old Testament record, Leviticus 17:11, it states the life of the soul is in the blood. I don't know when life ends, and I don't think science does either. We keep people alive as vegetables. It used to be a heartbeat, now we put mechanical hearts in. The Bible says the life of the soul, that enduring part, Old Testament scripture, right in the middle of the law passages, the life of the soul resides in the blood. And God has said, for sin comes death. The reason so much blood in the Old Testament, an awful lot of sin. I'm not one of those preachers who preaches on sin like the Jimmy Swaggart kind and run out to try to find out secretly how to do it. I stay off of that subject. The Bible in the Old Testament very simply defines sin. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to our own way. It's the misuse of freedom. God loved freedom enough, he risked a lot. He gave it to us, and that carried with it the power to abuse it or misuse it. And in the New Testament, Paul sums up sin with a Greek word, hamartia. It's to fall short. Not able to rise to God's standard in our strength. And the entire message of vicarious sacrifice, it's remembered by the Jews each time that they celebrate Passover. In the bondage of Egypt, the bondage of their own bringing about, because they Abraham had said, "God, how am I going to know this land's ours?" And God said, "I'll give you a lesson that'll teach you. It can't come about by chance. Your descendants will go to a strange land, they'll become slaves there, and in the fourth generation they'll come out richer than when they went in." And when that time came to demonstrate his control over history and ability to keep his word, he delivered them out of bondage with a simple act. They were to slay a lamb on the threshold of the door, put it on the post and the lintel. And as the avenging angel came through Egypt that night, the blood on the door, symbol of life poured out by a substitute taken by God, that token of blood on the door, you pass over that house. And when you read in Exodus, they marched out of Egypt, it says they went out harnessed. The original word is groups of five, the symbol of grace, unmerited favor. If you had a helicopter flying over, they marched out. Wish Cecil would be the meal and ask somebody and portrayed it this way. They marched out in groups of five, as though eternity looking on could see in the very number symbolizing grace that God had delivered them through his own goodness and nothing that they had done simply to keep his promise. But part of that deliverance was the shedding of blood. Now, whether it's true or not that Jesus performed this role, he viewed himself as that lamb, and he let John so designate him. He continually said he gave his life a ransom. His disciples would argue with him. He wouldn't allow it. He saw his mission as coming to give his life as a ransom to a people that understood in the liturgical frame that a ransom was the price you paid for one born of an unclean animal that was to be slain. In order that you might spare it, you paid the ransom. It's the one that is by sin or misdeed having lost an inheritance, you ransom it back
or you spare that which is destined to die because of God's law from death by the ransom. And he again and again in that theological frame referred to himself and his death as a ransom. Now, again, I just wish I could pull us out of theological la-la land. What would you really think if I, or anyone you knew, walked on this platform and tried to convince you that their death somehow would set right that which was wrong with the whole world? Again, the issue on each of these points has not one thing to do with whether or not it was true. Cry out a skeptic. I'm not saying Jesus had a right to seat authority in himself. I'm saying he thought he did. And he acted like he was all authority. I'm not saying Jesus thought he was perfect. Or rather, I'm not saying Jesus was perfect. What I am saying is he thought he was. I'm not saying that Jesus knew eternity from the inside. I'm saying he would have me believe that he did. I'm not saying that Jesus has a right to be the center of the religious universe. I'm saying he wants me to believe that in every source I find. I'm not saying that his death was a ransom. All I know is no other respected religious leader said that about himself. There's a book about 16 crucified saviors of history, but they're often the offscouring of theological and philosophic respect. Only Jesus is put on the plateau with the respected founders of religion, none of whom made such claims. Buddha's on record in his scripture, saying, "My death means nothing. I'm not even fit to lead this band." That's what in the Psalm Gitas they had to explain away. You don't find any such record by Christ that has to be explained away by his followers. From the outset, they proclaim these things. Buddha said, "My death means nothing. All I leave you is the way." Or they quoted Confucius. Muhammad never claimed to redeem anybody. He was a messenger who delivered what God, Allah, has shown you. You put people in a nut house that believe these things. My dad would lay hands on me at 84 if I embarrass him by making such claims. And this would be the last trip you made to this building to hear me preach if I made such claims. But Jesus did. Why is it that having made these claims, the world just doesn't seem to want to say, "Well, get him out of the respected crowd"? A long time ago, I decided if Jesus, and I had friends of every faith. I got people who listen to me of other faiths. I say, "I don't want to convert you. I want, if I could have influence, you to think your faith through and be more than a lip service religionist in your faith. I'd like to respect them for their position and to be respected for mine." And some fantasy la-la Jesus is what is being peddled in place of the historic Jesus that requires more than a casual look. He's either an absolute fraud, I concluded in my own study, who knows better, but for whatever ulterior purpose, in the gullible age in which he lived, he's trying to gather his followers with these impossible claims, which makes him not good, or he's just a little mentally off, who believes the impossible about himself. And once you recognize that and you can analyze his sayings and his good deeds, I mean, I've been all over India a few years ago, and they let people that would be in mental institutions here wander the streets and wander the countryside and show them respect. I mean, they're what materialistic West considers crazy is considered saintly in some of those circles, because these people we would call crazy have so little use for this life and the things that seem to be important, they're worshipped as having touched reality. And from our view, they might be crazy, but you analyze a few of their sayings. There's some of them true. I mean, even a crazy man, when the sun's shining, he says, I'm hot, is probably telling the truth. But that isn't what has been done with Jesus. I still remember a very close friend in graduate school. When we went down this list, he said, well, you know, now it's pointed out and assuming that all the sources have one or more of these claims in them, which I haven't had the time to look and see. Now, I'd agree. He made some pretty nutty claims about himself. But nevertheless, he was a good man, and he had some good things to say. That's a far cry from where they started as professors of mine to erode my faith. Most people, and all I've demonstrated at this point, is most people have a view of Christ not based on any research at all. They just bought what others have told them as an easy way to take an irritant and set it on the shelf and avoid having to ask the question, what kind of person can make these claims? I remember Canon Brian Green, equivalent of what the Billy Graham ministry has been in this country to the Baptists. He was the world voice of the Anglican Church, mostly in university study missions. And I said to him one day, why do you say that to come to God, you first got to believe that He is personal, and then you've got to believe that it's the nature of a person to reveal himself, and then because it's the nature of a person to reveal himself, you look for the revelatory deposit, and that leads you to his word, etc. He said, I don't know. Gene, I'm preaching in universities, and I'd just like to start with a philosophic premise. I've heard people say, well, the way to come to God is you've got to recognize there must be a first cause. And all of this didn't just happen. You go back somewhere to a first cause, and that's your starting point of God. There's either something wrong with my brain, or that didn't mix with me. I don't have any trouble believing in infinite regression. I don't have any more trouble believing things have always spun around than I do believe in a first cause. That didn't prove God to me. I've watched the church stumble around over evolution. Who cares about evolution? If God decided, He had two choices. If God created, and He decided to create in that evolving way with a positive force that develops through the years with more good mutations than bad mutations, let Him have His fun if He exists. If I were God, I'd create it this way in an instant to make it look that way, to keep you on the rack the rest of your life. Evolution doesn't matter to me. Why the church worries about this is beyond me. I don't start my faith there. All I know is that God breathed into an object made out of clay. Ruach is the word in the Hebrew, God's breath. And the King James says, man became a living soul. The literal is Adam became a living soul. God created Adam and breathed into Adam, and Adam became a living soul. King James loves to avoid using the same word twice in the sentence, and in so doing, they destroy the literal meaning. I know that, and I've told you this thousands of times, I find missing links. I find them every year. But Adam was something with an added dimension created by God if you have faith in the Hebraic Christian revelation. I don't start with any of that. Having become agnostic, confronted with these claims, and confronted with an intellectual world that would give him the designation good and wise teacher, what are you going to do with these good and wise declarations then? If he is the seat of all authority, where better to start in a definition of God? I'll let him define it for me. If he is what he viewed himself to be, morally perfect, than the other claims. As a ransom can make sense. If he did have this first-hand experience in eternity, he's a better guide than Jimmy Swaggart. That's for sure. He's a better guide than anyone else I know on the stage of history. If he is the center of the religious universe, what a relief it was to me to know that I had to relate to him instead of having grown up in a traditional church, all those other weights and burdens laid on me all my life. If he is the center of the religious universe, then I better get in orbit in a hurry. If he did remove the barrier, why all this guilt peddling? What a relief to know that it's been lifted. And if you want the Old Testament concept of the atonement topper, that mercy seat that covered the Ark of the Covenant, inside of which were the unbroken tablets of stone. Raised the lost ark was wrong. Moses broke the first set. The second set, intact, were put in the Ark of the Covenant. And on that great day of atonement, as the priest stood in the Holy of Holies to communicate with what was called in the Old Testament the Shekinah, God's presence, between him and the standard of God's holiness was that mercy seat with the cherubims who had the flaming swords at the door to the tree of life in the garden, if you believe the Old Testament, now with folded wings. Between the representative of the people and God's unbending righteous standard was the mercy seat. If, as Jesus claims, he provided that protective covering between us and God's standard, and that he offered his life a ransom, then get that guilt peddling off of my back that has gone on in the church for so long, and I'm free from that load. That's worth finding out. If he is what he claimed to be, doesn't mean I have to abandon, lose respect for, or push my way into any other faith. It just means that I have found a center of history that's as good a starting point for a definition of God as I need. I don't need to be a space case. If someone on the stage of history has these qualities genuinely, then there is no person in history I want to get better acquainted with. And add the sixth thing. He said, destroy this temple. 3 days it'll rise again. They thought he was talking about their temple. He made it clear he was talking about himself. He picked their Old Testament story of Jonah in the belly of the whale. Says if Jonah is in the belly of the whale, so would he. He again and again said that his was to give his life a ransom, but he would rise again. Now, I'm telling you something. Ed Masry and I have been friends for years. If Ed, I've been turned around. Don't you ever try these claims on me, Ed. I mean, you've sailed a few good ones by me, but don't try these. If Ed Masry made these claims, ceded authority, oh, I've said it to you, you're smart people. And he also said, destroy this body, put me in a tomb, and 3 days later I'm coming out. If you could get away from me long enough to get killed. And he came out of that grave 3 days later and sailed off in the blue. I'd take another look at him. Even Ed, it isn't that, if you're going to experiment, Ed, it isn't that you rise. It's that the man who made these claims is the same man who predicted he would rise and did. Oh, I know all the books. I taught for a year on Holy Blood, Holy Grail. They think he faked it and perfected the technique in his experiment with Lazarus. Well, let me tell you, there's abundant historical evidence to settle those issues.
And as a budding college student who had had his faith shaken, but who knew enough about the historic Christ to not buy this gumbo in its place, I had to settle it. For from my view, if the man who made these claims came out of the grave 3 days later and sailed off in the blue, then I'm going to give credence and take another look at these claims. I looked. 3.5 years. In all my years at university, I have yet to find or meet a man who says he doesn't believe the resurrection, but what I can ask 15 questions and prove by his responses he hasn't spent 15 hours of his life looking at the evidence. We're talking about a historic fact. I looked, and after 3.5 years came to the conclusion he came out of that grave. No other explanation. And because of that, I'm captured by these other claims. Now, I obviously, I'm not going to keep you here 2 hours now. Normally, when I preach on this subject, I dive immediately into the resurrection evidence. Today, I chose to lay this backdrop. Christ forces on you a choice. You either have to relegate him to the nutty fringe or to the fraud fringe for making claims no mortal man has a right to make about himself. Good if he believed them, but not wise. Wise if he deceived us in the claim, but not good. And the only thing that can give credence to these supernatural claims is if he came out of that grave. Now, that's a historic claim. You settle a historic claim by exposure to the evidence. Most people argue resurrection's a miracle. A miracle can't happen. Therefore, anybody that reports a miracle happening is a poor reporter because a miracle can't happen. Resurrections don't occur, so anyone who says they do is a poor reporter. Don't bother to read him because the resurrection is impossible, and anyone who says it happened must be lying because the resurrection can't go on. That's arguing in a circle. The Christian says, a resurrection of one who made these claims is startling enough to bring rigid attention on that foci the rest of your life. And the way to settle it is to spend, I suggest, more than I'm going to take next Sunday, but to spend at least the hour I'm going to take next Sunday to give the evidence why after 3.5 years I came to the conclusion he came out of that tomb. Now, you've got to go back next Sunday if you want to hear that. Today, the uniqueness of Christ simply is this. He strode onto the stage of history making claims about himself that preclude what the average mind wishes to do with a categorization of him. If they're wrong in that, just maybe the world's been wrong in its view of the resurrection. I'll tackle that here, same place, next Sunday.